Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Feigenbaum. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for having me. Always good.
Well, I just participated in a really interesting discussion on Radio Liberty, the Uzbek Service's daily show, and the whole focus was on why Uzbekistan and the Central Asian countries need to be the members of the SCO, that is Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Of course, Turkmenistan is not. But what is the point of being a member to this organization, and why should the region care about China and its bloc?
First of all, I think we need to recognize that the SCO is about to get bigger. And I have every expectation that the bigger the SCO gets, the less functional, less coherent, and frankly, less relevant this organization is going to become. And I will tell you, as somebody who's studied other regions of Asia, that that has also been the fate of nearly every multilateral institution in any and every part of Asia in the period since the end of the Cold War. So you asked me about the SCO, and you know I'm a former American official. So as a former American official, I won't cry any tears over that, because the idea of an exclusionary block-like arrangement in the central landmass of Eurasia, which is what this looked like it was becoming several years ago, makes me a little uncomfortable. But as an observer and an analyst, rather than as an American official, which is what I'm doing with you today, I will tell you that an expanded SCO is going to bump into some of the classic problems of multilateralism in Asia, and I would flag two for you. First, when the group gets bigger, form drives function rather than the other way around. And second, when that happens, then the group will grope around for a purpose. So I think that begins to answer your question, because you asked me why Central Asian countries would want to be in this group. And remember that when the SCO began, it had only five members, all of whom were focused on one goal and all of whom shared something in common. It was China and four Central Asian countries that shared a border with China. And the principal functional goal was to settle outstanding border disputes and claims. So once that was done, the group got bigger. It added Uzbekistan, as you said. It also added a bunch of observers and dialogue partners. And I would argue that it lost functional unity. So for example, two of the SCO dialogue partners are Belarus and Sri Lanka. And those are two countries that have literally nothing in common, and frankly, nothing really to do with one another. So the SCO story is, to me at least, converging more and more toward the story of other Asian multilateral institutions, which is that when they get too big, they become less coherent. And I think basically that's what's happening with the SCO. Form is taking over, and it seems to be driving out any meaningful shared sense of function. And I would say that that's even true of counterterrorism, which is the closest that they've come to defining a shared functional purpose. Because for one thing, India and Pakistan, two incoming members, do not at all share the same view of terrorism and counterterrorism. So the group's getting bigger, but it's losing a broad sense of functional purpose. And my sense is that there are some of the Central Asian members that actually are concerned about that. But at the end of the day, I think, frankly, that it's going to basically self-marginalize in time, and it's going to become lots of big symbolic meetings with photo ops and flags and press releases, but it will be harder to see it get anything tangible done.
And in that sense, it is similar to other international organizations, right? They just platforms for leaders to come together at least once a year, see each other, talk to each other. And other than that, honestly, when we were discussing this, the Uzbeks on the airwaves today were having a hard time defining what this organization stands for and what is the use, you know, for it, for the region, for Uzbekistan specifically. And on the other hand, my argument was that Uzbekistan cannot dare to leave it. I mean, Uzbekistan has to be a part of it, you know, because it's basically the only organization now that deals with the region with a special focus, because other than that, you don't have any regional blocs, right, in Central Asia. There is CIS, and then there are Russian-led organizations. This is the only organization that has China and Russia, major players in the region. And of course, nobody can deny the role of China and its growing influence in the region. So it's impossible, even if the Central Asian governments doubted the use of the SCO, they can't. They don't have the option of leaving it. They just have to be in it, no?
I've always thought that Uzbekistan in particular was one of the more, I guess the politest way to put it would be unruly members of these multilateral institutions, because it has been less enthusiastic. In other words, there seems to be less enthusiasm in Tashkent than in some of the other capitals for regional multilateralism. Now, as you said, there is a kind of alphabet soup of these groups, even in former Soviet countries. You mentioned the CIS, but there's also the CSTO, there was Eurasec, there's the SCO, and they all had different origins, but they've all basically foundered on some of the same problems, whether it's tensions among the Russia and the other countries or among the countries themselves. I think for Central Asian countries, this is a region that, as so many studies and scholars and officials have pointed out, badly needs to cooperate, but where cooperation and coordination have proved to be extremely elusive, even on the most basic things, you know, sharing water, crossing a border. And the reason has been partly connected to the post-independence aftermath. You know, prior to 1991, a lot of those decisions, and particularly the economic decisions, could simply be decided in Moscow by administrative fiat because the countries were part of the Soviet Union. So after 1991, these newly independent countries had to begin to reach complex intergovernmental arrangements on a lot of things that had essentially been decided for them or with them, but in any case in Moscow. And that's tough, and I think that has basically proved very elusive, and that's one of the tragedies of the last 20 years in Central Asia. Now, there are lots of ideas and arrangements and institutions, but I personally, as I said to you before, I think function rather than form is what really matters. And on any number of issues, informal, ad hoc, multilateral coordination usually proves more effective than these big groups. And I don't think that's just true, as you said, of Central Asia. And if you look across the rest of Asia, even at East Asia, where you have extremely well-developed economies, rich countries, countries that have a long experience of working together, we've had a lot of failure. I'll just give you one example. The ASEAN Regional Forum, which consists of 10 Southeast Asian countries plus the major external security players, the United States, China, Japan, Russia, South Korea, India, and so on. This was supposed to be the premier security grouping in Asia, but in every actual security or security-relevant crisis of the last two decades, the ASEAN Regional Forum has been paralyzed and pretty much irrelevant. And what you ended up with instead were informal coalitions of countries acting in an ad hoc way and almost always led by the United States. So that's what happened with the crisis in East Timor, with the avian influenza epidemic, with the SARS epidemic, with the cyclone in Myanmar, and so on. I can think of more examples. So to go back to the SCO where we started, the principal lesson, I think, is that function should drive form rather than the other way around. And as I said to you, what we see happening with the SCO now is that form is taking over and seems to be driving out any meaningful shared sense of function. And so I think the challenge they've got, if you're an individual government like the government of Uzbekistan or Kazakhstan, or you name your country, is really how to find ways to functionally coordinate on issues that matter irrespective of what happens within these groups. And there's another question, which is, I think, for the smaller members, and here I mean the Central Asian members, there is the question of how they relate to the big outside powers, Russia and China, and how they not get caught betwixt and between and essentially maintain their freedom of action and independence. And I do think that's going to be a question they face over the longer term. But frankly, even Russia and China, for all the form of it, have not always agreed on things in the SCO context. I think back to the events in Georgia in 2008, where my sense was that Moscow was trying to inject some ideological content into the SCO and didn't get a lot of traction. And I think that hasn't really been the case since the since what's happened in Crimea and Ukraine either. So I just have trouble seeing a lot of coherence here over the long term. But I think symbolically, there clearly are messages that certain members of the group are trying to send, not least to the United States and the West generally.
And we know that the Uzbek government so far has been the only government among the members to actually express some reservations, some hesitation about India and Pakistan joining the group. We will see how that will play out in this summit, which is taking place today and tomorrow in Tashkent. If we were to look at the track record of SCO, has there been any moments when SCO made itself relevant? I mean, we know that there has been a lot of talk about anti-terrorism efforts together, and there is some coordination, you know, in terms of sharing like blacklists and making sure that the dangerous citizens are kept away, you know. There is a lot of coordination that takes place. But other than that, what have we seen that we can look at and say, wow, you know, this is what SCO did?
Well, I can think of one or two moments. I mean, there was a period in the mid-2000s when the SCO members issued a statement basically calling for a timeline to end the coalition presence in Afghanistan that was associated with the fight against the Taliban in Afghanistan. And I can tell you, as someone who was a U.S. official at the time, that got a lot of attention in Washington and made all of us very uncomfortable because we couldn't figure out why countries that were expressing all of this support for the fight against terrorism and the fight against extremism and saying that they had shared interests in building a stable, secure Afghan state, why they would basically make a statement like that. And so at that time, that certainly got American attention, and there was a pretty significant effort by the United States to talk to these countries about what they had in mind and why they would make a statement like that. And I'm pleased to say that no further statements along that line recurred out of the SCO. So that was one moment where I think it had a kind of negative effect from an American standpoint. You know, there have been flirtations with relevance over time. You may remember that in 2009, for the first time, an American official at the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State level, this was somebody named Patrick Moon, who was working on Afghanistan at the time, he, I think, joined an SCO meeting as an ad hoc kind of informal observer.
Yes,
and the
we remember
idea,
that.
This is when the Obama administration first came into office, and the idea, I think, was to take a functional, as again, you know, function rather than form, a functional issue where there might be a shared convergence of interest and try to have a conversation about it. That, I mean, to the extent there's ever going to be a conversation between the United States or Western European countries and the SCO, that's the only way it's going to happen. But I think the larger point is there was an example of groping for some functional relevance. I think when I look at the SCO from outside, what I see most of the work trying to cohere around is counterterrorism. And there, I think this runs into a whole set of issues that have raised a lot of interest and sometimes hackles in the United States and in other Western capitals, which is, you know.
And in the region, too. And in the region, too.
Well,
because every time you talk about counterterrorism efforts, you know, within the SCO, we're quickly reminded about the fact that all the member countries are human rights violators.
Well, I mean, I think that counterterrorism question is what's meant by terrorism? Who are the targets? What's the basis of the coordination and so on? And I mean, I think there, from an American standpoint, there's some definitional differences and issues. I mean, your point about human rights, I mean, it's true that the SCO members up until this point have basically had a shared view of the arguments that have made by the United States and European countries about human rights. So the U.S.
and democracy
and
the reforms
see them as human rights violators. And so an American official at the time named Richard Boucher, who is the Assistant Secretary of State for South and Central Asia in the Bush administration, he used to say, I think he testified to Congress once, that the SCO is kind of, he called it a safe zone. In other words, where these countries could get together and they wouldn't have to listen to Americans and Europeans talk to them about democracy and human rights. So, yeah, I guess that's a shared view that they have, but that doesn't particularly get anything done, let's face it. So, I mean, does that make the SCO more of a relevant force in the world. I don't see it. I mean, and if anything, it isolates the members of the organization from the United States, from European countries. And India's entry into the group will be interesting in that respect, because while India is not particularly messianic about its democracy externally, it is a successful, thriving, multicultural, multilinguistic, multiethnic democracy that in many ways on those issues is a kind of natural ally of the United States. So it'll be interesting to watch how that dynamic plays out with India now inside the grouping.
And it's been very interesting to watch how Indians are actually discussing this too.
Well, I think it's clear what India wants out of membership. It wants closer linkages to Central Asia, particularly for economic linkages. And so, you know, there's been a lot of talk in India over the years about how to link up to Central Asia more, despite historical affinities and connections. You know, for instance, the Mughal Empire, the great Mughal Empire of India, it began, you know, with, if you read the Babarnama, you know, Babur was a Timurid prince and came from the Fergana Valley. So there are those historical linkages, but they're not relevant anymore.
Yeah, but, you know, but if India wanted to develop its economic relations with Central Asia, it can't do that without the SCO. I mean, we cannot look at the SCO and say, wow, you know, it's because through this block you can really achieve some kind of economic success.
I agree. And I've made that argument to Indian friends. But I mean, I think that what India is looking to do is to expand, intensify, and multiply its linkages to Central Asian countries. And so the SCO is viewed by many people as one tool in that toolkit. So I'm not at all surprised that India wanted membership in it. I think the question, though, is how you, as you just said, leverage membership into tangible action that's relevant. Nobody needs the SCO for that. And the best example of that is China. There's been a lot of talk over the years about economic linkages among SCO members, but the principal driver and channels and mechanisms for China's really expanded economic influence in Central Asia have been bilateral. They've had absolutely nothing to do with the SCO.
Absolutely.
You know, these lending vehicles, you know, 10 billion for Kazakhstan and, you know, however many billions for Turkmenistan associated with gas pipelines, those were all bilateral vehicles. These were not SCO loans. They were Chinese loans through the China Development Bank or the China Exim Bank. So I think India is going to find the same thing, that the SCO won't really be an economic bloc. But I'm not surprised that India wanted membership. But let's face it, having India and Pakistan in won't necessarily lead to more coherence. I mean, look at the SARC. It hasn't produced more coherence in the South Asian regional context through the SARC.
Well, every time I have asked officials from the region, what is the point of being an SCO, the answer pretty much has been, well, you know, we need a platform. We need a place where we can come together and talk. So it's a talking place, you know. They don't necessarily define it as a place or as a block where they go and resolve issues. But I want to go back to something that you mentioned earlier. I remember those hearings with Richard Boucher in U.S. Congress. And there was one question at that time that is still asked sometimes whenever a CEO comes up. Richard Boucher at that time was asked, I think this was Congressman Chris Smith asking, Republican from New Jersey, whether U.S., you know, had ever considered joining the SCO or whether it had ever considered becoming an observer in that bloc. Richard Boucher's answer was no.
You have a long memory. remembering congressional hearings in the mid-2000s.
Well, it's my job, you know.
Yes. So, well, I think at that time, I mean, I will tell you that when I was in the government, we did have discussions about what the U.S. posture toward the SCO should be. And so we looked at a whole range of possible options and came out where we came out, which was with a pretty standoffish relationship to the SCO. And I mean, I think part of why we had that discussion is because we were really concerned about this statement that was made calling for a timeline on coalition operations. And so, you know, U.S. government looks at all kinds of policy issues at the time. And so, you know, we talked about what is this SCO thing. I gave a speech in 2007 about U.S. policy toward the SCO. I think my sense is that, you know, for over 10 years now, there's been kind of a general discussion among scholars and inside and outside the government about what the heck the SCO is and what the U.S. ought to do about it. In 2009, when there was that Patrick Moon liaison with the SCO, as I recall, That was the first time where it looked like the U.S. was trying to think more about whether it would have a relationship with the SCO.
And since then, we haven't really heard much discussion about it. Obviously,
yeah, no,
know,
yeah no.
Behind closed doors, a lot is talked about. But my observation is, as a journalist, nothing really has changed in terms of the U.S. attitude or strategy towards this organization,
yeah,
which is
they,
we just watch, right?
I don't think the U.S. wants anything to do with it. I mean, we didn't, and it doesn't sound like anybody does now. I presume that as this thing evolves over time, people will in the United States will look at, you know, does it cohere? Does it have a functional purpose? What is that functional purpose, if there is one? And what does that functional purpose mean for American interests? And that'll be the basis on which the U.S. needs to decide its posture. But as I said to you at the beginning and throughout this conversation, my supposition and my prediction is that the SCO will get bigger but less coherent and therefore will become less meaningful over time. And if I were the United States, I would be looking at ways to form informal partnerships with different groups of countries, some of whom may be SCO members and some of whom may not be, around specific functional issues. So if it's Afghanistan related, if it's financial and economic related, if it's regional connectivity related, if it's environment related, the countries and issues may or may not be different. You want those that bring the greatest capacity to bear on a particular problem as your partners. And so I just tend to like more informal ad hoc approaches to these kind of things. And that's how I think the U.S. ought to think about it. And frankly, that's how China thinks about it. Look at the range of tools China has. China has these bilateral lending vehicles. It has the SCO. There's now this Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank that is a multilateral development bank, but China's been the motive force behind it. It has other arrangements. You know, a lot of what President Xi Jinping is announcing in Tashkent now is completely bilateral. It's part of the China-Uzbekistan relationship. It has nothing to do with the SCO, even though he's there for a summit. It's part of his Belt and Road initiative, which is bilateral. So I think, you know, a range of partnerships, a range of tools, that's the way to think about it if you want an activist diplomacy.
And we will obviously continue to watch.
Well, you certainly will.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Dr. Feigenbaum. We can talk about this forever. I know that. This is it for now, and thank you so much.
Great. Thanks for having me.